Gardening can be a real pleasure, but even when we take good care of our plants, nature doesn't always cooperate. This summer's drought put a lot of stress on plants, and when they're stressed, they're less able to fight off pests and disease. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. So glad you could join us on the Ideas Network. We have two very knowledgeable and even fun guests with us for Garden Talk today. Brian Huddleston is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic at the UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology. Brian, always wonderful to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And his partner in crime is Liz Freemuth, previously a horticulturalist for Walworth County and now the owner of The Garden Hoe, a passion for healthy and happy plants. It's a concierge horticulture service. Liz, always great to have you back too.
Oh, thanks so much for the invitation.
Partners in crime, yes. I love it.
I like that. That's very apropos.
Well, and you two are great because between the two of you, we can really talk about anything that's going on with folks' plants, and I want to let them know how they can join in. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, and you can go to our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show, and Mueller is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. You can post a photo there if you're having a problem with a plant, and Liz and Brian will be happy to take a look at that. So lots to talk about today, but of course, as I feel like practically every Garden Talk this whole spring, summer, and now into the fall has dealt with, there's the drought and what the drought meant for plants. And, you know, we've gotten some rain in the last few weeks around the state, but, you know, I'm not sure, it might be too little too late. Liz, with the drought conditions of the year stressing a lot of plants, what kind of effects are you still seeing now into the fall?
Boy, out in the field, it is really interesting. And we are seeing some discoloration that I've never seen before. And I'm sure Brian will attest to that for samples, too, coming in. We are seeing discoloration, dead needles on plants that really don't exhibit those symptoms at any other time. And so to me, it's a combination of drought and high temperatures, the both of them. And
so it's not just a lack of moisture. It was extremely...
Yeah, some of it can actually be just temperature-wise.
Yeah.
Okay.
It really can. You know, and when we look at those zones, typically we look at the cold, hardy zones, but there's also a heat-tolerant zone as well. And we went way south this year. Our weather went way south of what our plants will normally handle. And Brian and I were talking about that on the way in. I have people saying, well, what do I do about this? And, you know, I hate to admit it, but there are some instances where I have to say, I really don't know what we're going to expect.
And sometimes it's not much is the answer.
Well, and just like it was unexpected for plants, it's not things that you've dealt with as horticulturalists either.
Exactly. But, you know, the upside is that we've had perfect weather for bulbs, perfect weather for spring plants because things like bleeding heart, they actually like it a little bit dry during the summer. And now that we've got the moisture, that will actually get those things to produce nice roots for spring and coming up in the spring. So some of those will do really well. Shrubs that really got way too dry that are spring bloomers, we'll see how they do.
I'm expecting that on a lot of plants, it's just not that they had a lack of water. There was probably such a lack of water that the root systems were actually damaged physically from the lack. Yeah. And certainly a lot of heat stress on leaves, branches, needles. I'm getting a lot of conifers that come in with a lot of browning needles at the tips of branches, which is typically an indication of some sort of drought stress or heat stress. So there are going to be lasting effects of this, I think, even into the next couple of years. We have certain trees, when they go under water stress, like oaks, that tend to be more attractive to insect pests. So there's an insect called two-line chestnut borer, where I would expect more activity from that particular insect just because the trees are very attractive to those insects at this point.
And are they attractive because they're vulnerable or?
Probably a combination of both. Okay. Also because oftentimes under stress, plants will give out particular compounds that the insects can sense, and that actually gets them closer and
interesting
to colonize the tree.
I remember actually doing a program that was talking about the senses that plants use, and one was that a plant can often sense when a nearby plant is being attacked by insects or disease, because they're picking up on those chemicals being released. So it sounds like it can be both a plus and a minus, because it's making it more obvious to the pests too.
Definitely, some insects are very attuned to the two particular chemical signals that can be given off by plants.
And speaking of the issues that we've been seeing this year, Brian, what diseases have been prevalent at the clinic?
I think one of the groups that I saw that I was a little bit shocked at, because they tend to like a little bit more moisture, is a lot of downy mildews. So there's a group of diseases caused by a particular group of organisms, and they're foliar diseases. And I saw more downy mildews this year than I've seen in any other year on a wide variety.
Overhead watering?
Not necessarily, but I think perhaps there was enough moisture early in the season to get these established, and then they did fairly well later on. But we saw it on, you know, cinquefoils. We saw it on hops. I saw on basil. We saw basil downy mildew later in the season. So they were out and about. We also saw lot of tar spot on maples.
Amazing this year,
yeah,
isn't it?
And I think, again, we probably had a good moist period early in the season. Mm-hmm. There had been kind of an increase, certainly in the Madison area, of that disease last year that I'd noticed. And certainly in my yard, I had a lot of it, but I was bad and didn't do my normal, well, I shouldn't say normal for me, my suggested fall cleanup. I did not do myself, and I didn't get out in
the
spring.
Is this a do as I say, not as I do moment?
Definitely for me.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes, I'm
notorious for leaving things in the garden over the wintertime.
You know,
like I'm
liken it to the cobbler's kids not wearing shoes. Yeah. You know, we know what causes it, and yet sometimes we don't have the time to actually get out and take care of our own. We're taking care of clients, we're taking care of people in the clinic, et cetera.
Well, actually, we recently had someone call into Garden Talk who said he prefers doing spring cleanup to fall cleanup, because he feels like, especially things like dried leaves, actually catch more snow, and so there's a better protective snowpack, and some things like pine branches and things like that can actually help those, you know, overwintering plants.
And I tend to recommend that on occasion as well, because for an insulation, the leaves will work quite well. And again, I do think they will trap more snow if we get it. The thing is that once the spring arrives, you need to get that material off as quickly as you possibly can, because a lot of the disease-causing organisms that I deal with will survive in that old leaf debris. And that's certainly true of tar spot, because those big black spots you see in the leaves, that's where the fungus, that's actually the fungus that you're seeing. And it's going to produce spores next spring, whether those leaves are alive or dead.
And we're talking about not an extensive amount of hours of the appropriate temperature in order for those things to go boof.
Right. And the other thing, it doesn't take oftentimes a long period where the new leaves on the trees are wet for these spores that are produced to germinate and infect the tissue. And I was seeing tar spot infections very early, probably April or May, early May of last year.
It was
incredible.
Very early. And, you know, and I agree. It's like when you can get out there, but you have to monitor the temperatures. That's like with pre-emergent weed control, anything like that. If you're not monitoring temperatures, paying attention, it's going to get away from you very, very quickly.
Yeah. It's Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry and talking with Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemuth. And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. And we do have some folks online, so let's go to the phones now. Tom in Whitewater. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I have a problem that I think is probably one of the most common ones in Wisconsin. I have a small garden plot, and I've been using it exclusively to grow tomatoes for years. I did not, and I have that blight fungus problem with tomatoes. I did not want to chemically sterilize the plot, so what I did is I decided to bite the bullet. I took it offline all summer and had it covered with plastic to try to cook out the problem. I'm wondering now, what is there I can do now or in the spring to try to maximize that plot for growing tomatoes? I also have never tested it in any way.
Okay.
So it's like I'm hoping to sort of start over again.
All right, Tom, let's see what Brian and Liz have to say.
Yeah, the tomato, have you seen this problem in the past, the blight? Okay, is it start at the bottom of the plants and work its way up?
Not quite sure.
Okay, because there are a couple of different tomato blights. There's the more common tomato blights, and there are two diseases that tend to cause that sort of blight, and these work from the bottom up. There's a disease called early blight, another one called septoria leaf spot. Those you treat a little bit differently than the other major tomato blight, which is late blight. That one will tend oftentimes, because the spores are coming in from an outside source, will oftentimes start towards the top of the plant and work its way down. That particular organism I would not expect to survive in soil. This is the late blight organism. Unless you are growing something like potatoes and you leave tubers in the soil that that have become infected and then resprout the following spring.
So you wouldn't think a tomato would do that?
No, tomato. The only, we have kind of hypothesized that if you had a a compost pile and you threw some infected tomato fruits in that and they didn't totally rot over the wintertime, that might be a source of this particular organism. But again, if you're doing good cleanup and getting rid of all that infected material, hot composting, I wouldn't expect that to be an issue. The more common of the leaf blights, the septorial leaf spot and early blight, those tend to survive in little tiny bits of old tomato debris that kind of filter into the soil. So the first line of defense for those is good fall cleanup. So make sure you're getting rid of as much of those old tomato plants as you possibly can and just get them out of your yard. You technically could hot compost them, but most people just kind of have a pile of plants where they throw their old dead plant material. That's not a good thing. That can be a source of the spores. The next thing that you can do is if you till a little bit, you want to get any of that material, that tomato material that's still left buried and rotting as quickly as possible. And if you can get that to decay, then these sorts of blight organisms don't survive. They don't survive in straight soil. It has to be in association with old tomato debris. Then I think the plastic that you use, the heating, will provide some useful eradication of these fungi just from the heating, although oftentimes solarization, as we call it, just doesn't work that well in Wisconsin, although last year probably did.
Yeah, I was going to say this summer.
In a typical year, usually not. It's cloudy enough that we don't get enough continuous days where it's really hot, but last year probably worked quite well. The other thing I would do, since you're growing in a normal garden where you have different vegetable crops, I would say rotate, move the plants around. It doesn't sound like the caller is doing that because they're growing just exclusively tomatoes, but plant the tomatoes as far apart as possible, and you want to promote real rapid drying of the plants if they get wet, because these fungi tend to infect plants that are wet for long periods.
So you're saying basically not to crowd them.
Don't crowd the plants. I typically tell folks, if you have a sense of how big your tomatoes are going to be at maturity, you want to space them apart so they don't have any overlap of foliage when they're full size. And then get in there once you've planted the plants and mulch, about an inch of mulch. And that's as a physical barrier. This prevents any spores that are being produced getting out of the soil and onto the plants. And oftentimes you can get relatively good control of the disease in that manner.
Great. All right. Thanks for that call, Tom. And you can also join us by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also post a photo or a question or comment on our Facebook page. And we actually have a very interesting one from Emily, who's a naturalist at the Cable Natural History Museum in Cable, Wisconsin. And she says a museum member found this oak leaf with blue spots while walking through the woods. It was the only one nearby, and it wasn't near a painting project. It has us completely stumped. And it really is. It's like bright teal spots.
That's kind of aqua turquoise. Yeah. That's very, very odd.
I can't see that. Does she say that they're raised at all?
She doesn't say that they are.
It just says spots.
Yeah, just
right.
Spots.
Yeah, that would be one of the things where I'd say get a sample in for us to look at. It could be insect-related, although I've never seen any of the insect galls have been
blue,
that color.
Yeah, I've not seen blue galls, but that doesn't mean they aren't out there. Mm-hmm. I just have not seen them.
The other thing would be to see if it is some sort of fungal growth. There certainly are fungi that will produce spores that are that color, but I've never seen it. Those associated with oak leaves or in that discrete an area. So if they really want to know what it is, they should get a sample in my clinic.
And actually, that is really fascinating.
It is. It's fascinating. And it really is bright aquamarine.
Yeah, very, very colorful.
I would like to see that in person. Definitely.
Well, actually, Brian, why don't you tell people how they can submit things?
Yeah, you can send it to my clinic. It's called the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic. And if you need information on how to send in a sample, I'm just going to refer you to our website, which is pddc.wisc.edu. And there's a section on that website on sample submission. Just click on that, and it gives all kinds of directions on how to package stuff up, how to collect it, and also our mailing address on how to send it in.
And we do have a link to that on the Facebook page. Again, pddc.wisc.edu. We also have a link to Liz's business, The Garden Hoe, as a comment there, too. And that's just The Garden Hoe with an E on the end of hope.
Thank you.
.com. So you can find her there. Well, let's go back to the phones and check in with Phil in McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Hi, good morning. I have a little minor story I want to run by your experts and ask them their opinion. I grow a fair amount of bleeding hearts and some other perennials in my garden. And this year, under stress conditions, I had what I would call intermittent, very light spotting on some of the leaves, not by any means overrun or variegated or anything, but some spotting. So I'm a member of the Perennial Plant Association, so I contacted some fellows at Ohio State because I had nothing to do one day, and they gave me a referral to a fellow from their pathology department who's a professor emeritus, and they said, you have to have some time because he's an interesting guy, but he'll be happy to talk to you. Anyway, I called this fella and described the symptoms to him, and when I was about 30 seconds, he said, "You have bleeding hearts, and that means I'm going to tell you you have virus." He said, he gave me a very lengthy story, and although I can't remember his name right now, he said to me, normally in our lab we check perennials, and it's particularly bleeding hearts, things like epimediums. About 85% of them symptomatic or non-symptomatic, so whether they're showing the symptoms or not, will come up positive for virus. And he said the reason we don't catch the other 15 is we do a lousy job at testing. He said the way they're grown in Europe and other places, year after year, you're a bleeding heart specialist or an epimedium specialist. Grow it on the same land your father grew it on, your grandfather grew it on. Right. And he said, "I feel a virus is a much bigger problem than anybody realizes, but I feel it's so prevalent in perennials, I don't know that it can ever really be controlled, and the symptoms only happen when they're under extreme stress."
Well, Brian is nodding here, yeah. So I think he has some advice for you.
Well, I have a bleeding heart in my yard that has a viral infection. I know because I've had it tested, and it only shows symptoms sporadically. Hmm. Mine shows a line pattern, which is, I think, a little bit more typical for that particular host. The spotting definitely could be viral. And my guess, the one type of virus that we typically find in things like bleeding heart and epimedium, there's one called tobacco rattle virus. And again, it's going to be propagated. If you're doing any sort of clonal propagation where you're taking cuttings and rooting them, that's a great way to basically carry the virus from plant to plant. You get the mother plant infected, and then any of the cuttings that you take are going to have the virus as well. The only real recommendations on my part are to either live with it or dig up the plant and destroy it, because viruses mm-hmm. tend to be systemic. That means they're spread throughout the entire plant, and there's really no cure for those particular types of diseases. Where I would be cautious, if you have a plant that you think has a virus of this sort, would be if you're anywhere in an area that produces a lot of potatoes, because this tobacco rattle virus goes to potatoes mm-hmm. and causes some serious problems in the tubers. It causes little brown dead flecks in the interior tissue. And if you're growing those potatoes to make chips out of them, when you fry them up, all those little brown spots turn black, and you end up with potato chips with black spots, which are mm-hmm. our consumers just love. If it's in a home garden in our area, I see you're in northern Illinois, I wouldn't expect there's a lot of potato production there. I would say you could keep it, and you are probably going to see some of these spots every once in a while. Again, you do run the risk of it spreading to other hosts, because this particular virus does have a fairly wide host range, if it's the one I'm thinking of. And it's interestingly, it's nematode transmitted. So there are little worms that are in the soil. If you have a particular type of nematode called the stubby root nematode in your soil, it can pick up the virus, and then as it feeds on other plants can transmit it. So in general, you know, it's either live with it or get rid of the plant.
So really no mm-hmm. treatment.
No treatment at all. No.
You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. It's Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Happy to be with you. Brian Huddleston is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic in the UW Department of Plant Pathology. And Liz Freemuth was previously a horticulturalist for Walworth County and is now the owner of The Garden Ho, a passion for healthy and happy plants. She provides concierge horticulture services, and they are here to help you with your garden problems. You can call 1-800-642-1234 to join the conversation. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer, will be happy to take those calls. And you can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question, comment, or plant disease photo, or any kind of plant photo for that matter, on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show, and that's M-E-I-L-L-E-R. Well, let's go back to the phones and talk with Bill in Dubuque. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. I have two perennials that I'd like to know about. One is this a good time or better in spring to transplant crown vetch?
Crown vetch? Why would you want to transplant crown vetch?
I know it's vigorous when it's got a good, happy place. But
vigorous is an understatement, yeah. Okay.
But I've got a couple of, we're on a farm, and I've got a couple of spots that don't grow things very well, and crown vetch is alongside a road.
Yeah, crown vetch, you can rip it up out of the ground, throw it down, step on it, and it'll grow almost any time of the year. So,
So I guess
you're okay. And we actually have some moisture in the soil right now, so it's a good time to move a lot of those perennials if you can provide a little bit of care right now. As even though we've got some soil moisture, we also have temps for the next 10 days or so that are only going to be between the low 30s and the upper 40s. So we're not talking about a lot of root development, although the soil is still a little warm. Mm-hmm. By the time we get to the end of this 10 days, it's not going to be so warm. So you do want to make sure that you're providing a bit of care, make sure it gets watered in, even though it's cold out there, make sure it gets watered. But then also don't mulch right now, not until after the ground freezes solid, because otherwise disturbing those roots and exposing that nice, healthy, succulent flesh will just encourage all sorts of rodents to come and do bed and breakfast over winter. So if you wait until after the ground freezes solid to mulch, and then you can moderate those temperatures, you're going to resist a lot of rodent infestations.
Okay.
I have to say I would put in a comment here that I would try to look for something other than crown vetch. That's a pretty invasive plant, and once you get it established, it's very difficult to get rid of it.
Well, and so, actually,
they have cattle, and they'll knock it down, you know, except on the side of the road. It's a pretty contained area.
Okay.
But the other question.
Well,
was,
then I would also worry about toxic. Are your cattle eating it? Because that would be another concern with me with that particular plant about whether it's toxic to your cattle. That's something you should investigate as well before you put it in an area where you might have cattle munching on it.
Well, since you brought up the subject, what about the castor plants?
Oh, very toxic.
For cattle.
For almost everything. Mm-hmm. And I think for ruminants, you really have to watch out for a lot of things. Even May apples are toxic to any type of ruminant.
Yeah, I would definitely, since you have animals in the area that might be eating these plants, that's something that you need to investigate with someone who knows probably a little bit more than either one of us before you plant stuff there.
Yeah, and out in that area, I would suggest that they've got pretty decent. I would think they've got pretty decent extension people out there that can help you, that specialize in cattle fodder and growing kind of green manure type things. I know out in that area there are going to be private organizations that can help you out as well. And it is tough. I know that area. It is tough to get something to grow because usually you have to have one leg shorter than the other to walk out in that area. It's quite hilly. And so you can run into problems of what can you get to grow as a feed crop. But I would say ask, you know.
Yeah, I would definitely check that out before you plant anything in that area because you could end up poisoning your cattle.
I'm only using the castor around my vegetable garden to keep the moles away. And it really works.
Yeah, if you don't have anything else to worry about, small kids, small pets, then you should be fine with that. I grow castor bean myself and just make sure that I'm taking the seed pods off and that nothing's chewing on it that shouldn't be chewing on it.
My question was, I imagine it's the same as crown vetch. Ferns, is it a good time to transplant ferns?
Kind of depends on the fern, but most of them, definitely. Some of those early spring ones, I would wait just a pinch longer before I dig them up and move them, just because they're some of mine in my yard, I've seen a resurgence somewhat, and so you want to be a little careful with them. But any of the Dryopteris, they're looking fantastic right now, nice and healthy. This is their time of the year.
Is there a common name for that one?
Wood fern,
okay.
I think. Yeah. I'm not real good with common names. I'm sorry. But it is a dry area wood fern. It tolerates shade. Some of the Japanese painted are in that family. They're kind of bred within that family. And so some of those are easily moved right now.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of ferns. I
love
just
them.
Love them.
Love them.
And again, I would caution because I believe some of the ferns can be toxic as well. So
yeah.
Again,
so if you're
you
if
need
this
to get
is
more
all
information.
For feed, but if this is for purely ornamental, then
where their cattle aren't
going
to be anywhere close, then you're fine.
Mm-hmm. All right, great. Thanks for that call, Bill. And let's go right to Rod in Superior next. Hi, Rod.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Do you have snow up there?
I planted a red maple tree in May of 2010. It was 3 inch in diameter. Last 2011, it grew real well. This year, it seemed like the west side of the tree didn't have any leaves. The east side had leaves all year. They were real good. It had grew some last year. I had a plastic ring around it, the trunk, and I might have taken it off too long. But the, like I said, the west side never grew any leaves. And now during the middle of the summer, I had a crack on the north and south side of the bark from the top all the way down, and the bark was starting to come off. And the only thing I could think of is last year I put one of those fertilizer spikes on the west side of the tree, probably about 3 feet away from it. And everybody says it might come back, but I need some advice.
Yeah, let's see what our guests have to say. Liz?
Well, it really depends. Cracking, yes, you know, that far north and a relatively smooth bark maple at that age, I would expect some cracking. But I have a question for you. When this was transplanted, did you transplant it or did you have it done?
I transplanted it.
Okay. Did you leave? Was it a bald and burlapped plant or was it out of a container?
Yeah. I believe it was out of a container. I can't remember for sure.
Okay. A couple of things that you have to watch for, either when you're watching somebody else, and I encourage people to watch other people as they're planting in your yard because that's your tree. Common practice was, up until a short time ago, that you left the burlap and you left the twine on that tree and just popped it right in the ground. Couple of issues with that definitely they've been finding over the last 5 to 7 years is that burlap doesn't necessarily disappear and disintegrate, and neither does the twine. And what you end up with is you end up with roots that are circling around, and you can get that same thing in a container if it's been a containerized tree for quite some time. And they're planted deep, and so that actually encourages those roots to climb and twirl around. And what you can get is a girdling root, which will cut off the system of that tree, often on the side that's girdled. And in a tree that size, that might be what you're looking at. If you don't get leaves on one side of a tree, I look physically at that. And that means that getting the spading fork out, digging the soil around it, and actually taking a look, you should be able to see if it's a girdling root within. And you have to be very, very careful. You do more damage than if you left it alone. And just dig around and see if you can find that.
Again, and girdling means basically like kind of folding in on itself,
like
and choking itself.
They
like
grow around the trunk.
And it really, that root doesn't expand at the trunk. The trunk pushes against the root. Mm. And so once it's there, the root starts pushing and it really kind of chokes itself off in doing that. And so you want to check for that. But then the other thing I would look environmentally is on the west side, do you have a farm field on the west side? And I ask this all the time, you know, are you next to a farm field that would spray Roundup? And are you?
Yeah, I believe I took that burlap off in it.
Okay. Now, and when you're looking at the environment that it's planted in, you do have to consider whether you're close to a farm field or not, because the standard is that most farm fields will be sprayed with Roundup once, twice, three times a year. And if the temperatures are high, which is what we had, potentially you can have volatilization of chemicals that are there and it will drift even if it's done on a calm day, et cetera. So you have to really take a look at that as well. So from what we have, it's difficult to say exactly what caused it, but those are some of the potential issues. And the heat, you know, if it gets bright, intense afternoon heat and light, and in a year like this where it maybe didn't get enough moisture, that might be enough to take out part of the branching structure,
right,
as well.
It doesn't,
of course,
sound...
then there's also verticillium that take it out.
I'm not as inclined to think it's verticillium mold. This is a fungal disease that will oftentimes cause a sectional dieback in particularly maple trees, but a lot of other types of trees as well. Because you're talking about
it's
cracks,
too new, actually,
bark
too.
Coming off, the relative age of the tree. We did come through a really tough summer where there could be some physical damage from sun. I'm more inclined to think it's not that particular disease. But what is concerning me is, at this point, it sounds like you've got a fair amount of that tree that is not doing well. Mm-hmm. You could go out and just use your fingernail on one of the branches that's been dead over the summer to see if it's green or not underneath, in which case that would... give you an indication of whether those branches are still alive, but I'm suspecting they're probably not. And then it comes down to a question of, are you going to be able to resuscitate enough of that tree for it to be an aesthetic benefit to your landscape?
Right, yeah.
In which case, because it's a relatively newly transplanted tree, you might be better off transplanting a new one in its place.
You get rid of it before you get attached.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and before it's too big, too, because right. I'm assuming it's harder and harder to
get rid of. I do practice this in my own yard and for clients as well. The gardens and the plants are supposed to work for you, not the other way around. So if it's something that is not aesthetically pleasing, and especially one that's relatively new like that, I agree with you. It's like,
again,
you know,
cost,
be cruel.
Cost
be cruel.
Is a question, too. You may not be able to afford to put in a new tree, but if you have that option, it's sounding pretty That tree sounds pretty tough to me right now, and I'm not sure you're going to be able to get it to survive or at least look particularly good long term.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with that, Rod. And actually, talking about a pretty young tree, it's probably first or second full summer being the kind of summer that we had with those high temperatures. Actually, up in Superior, they also had the deluge.
Rain.
And you know, so are younger trees, especially in shrubs, more susceptible to the effects of the drought?
Well, yes and no. You know, yes and no. The nice thing is, yes, because they're tender and they're not established and they don't have the defense mechanisms, deep roots, et cetera, to really reach for any little bit of moisture that's in the soil. But the no part of that is at least it's a controllable watering space where you can get at that and actually get water down into those roots. Where with mature plants, oftentimes there's no way you can water enough because everything sucks out to the dry soil. So it makes it a little bit easier to monitor, but because they're not established, they're a lot more susceptible and they will fail more quickly if they're kind of left on their own.
Right, and you need to water, particularly the first probably 2 to 3 seasons that you have that tree in. You have to give it more water than for an established tree. So I usually say roughly 1.5 to 2 inches of water per week. And you need to be using something like a soaker hose to get that moisture into the soil and to the roots. If you're using a sprinkler system, that's probably not going to deliver the amount of water that you need.
And a lot of it's not getting where you need it.
Yeah, exactly.
This past summer was so tough. You could have been watering as much as we normally recommend or more, and I'm not even sure some things would have survived. It was just a tough summer on
so
your
extreme.
And you have to remember that's 1 to 2 inches equivalent rainwater.
Right.
So that means that everything is getting 1 to 2 inches. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if you give that one tree 2 inches in 1 3/4 sucks out to the dry soil that surrounds that, you're still only at 1/4 inch.
Right.
And so it is a very difficult thing in the weather we've had to even remotely keep up.
Right.
You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today and talking with Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemuth. And our phone lines are full, but you can email us at talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org, or post a question, comment, or photo on our Facebook page. And Brahm in Floodwood, Minnesota has a question. Hi, Brahm.
Yes, good morning to you. I appreciate the help. Question, this summer I bought a Meyer lemon, anticipating success, and I kept it on the deck. Did very, very well, no insects. I didn't overwater or over-fertilize it, I don't believe. Brought it inside and placed it in a position, patio door. It gets morning sunlight, excuse me, through early afternoon, and it just exploded with blossoms here about 3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago. I don't associate blossoming with fall, especially in Minnesota.
That's why we love our citrus. It's actually right on schedule.
Oh, really?
Yes, that is a winter-producing plant. I don't care how often we move them in and outside up north here, they're going to be on their own schedule. And you can actually get a couple fruitings throughout our growing season. You might get a light one during the early summer. But the main portion is going to happen. You're going to see fruit in January, February. And for you, you know, we're right on schedule for that because it's going to take about 6 to 8 weeks for you to start getting fruit. So you're right on top of it. It's doing exactly what it should do for you.
What should I be doing for it?
Well, it sounds like you're doing everything perfectly.
To get that many flowers, that's great.
If you've got that much, you're doing fine. That you've got those flowers on there, I would cut back just slightly on the fertilizer, just slightly, until you start to see those fruit develop. And If you haven't been using a citrus fruit fertilizer, I would get one and use that. When you move it into the house, any plant you move into the house, you're cutting the light back by 65 to 85%, no matter if it's in full sun or not. Just that's what we get for being behind windows. And the humidity is going to drop tremendously, being in the house versus outside. So what you might want to do is provide a humid environment with rocks in a tray underneath, and not have the bottom of that pot actually touch that water at all, period. You just want that water to evaporate underneath that tree and let it get to the leaves, etc. But aside from that, that's really all you need to do. They're going to just manage on their own just fine. You might want to thin it a little bit.
Yeah, the other thing that I suggest would be to watch for, sometimes lemons get mite problems.
Yes.
So
yes.
You might have brought those in from outdoors. So definitely watch to see if you see any kind of yellowing and speckling on the leaves or any
webbing
or any kind of sticky drops that might indicate insect activity.
Yeah, and if you keep moisture, if you keep, little pan of rocks with water in it underneath there. And you don't even have to put rocks. It can just be a pan of water. It's fine. If you want to set the container into it, put rocks so it doesn't touch the water. But having a little bit of moisture and humidity will help keep that mite population under control somewhat. They don't like things moist. But you're doing fine.
And I wanted to go back, Liz, to what you said about thinning. Did you mean getting rid of some of those blossoms?
Yeah. And, you know, if this is this your first year doing citrus?
I did something like that about 10 years ago with some modest success.
Okay. Well, if this is your first winter with this particular plant, I would wait until the fruit starts to develop. And if you've done this before, you can kind of see how things are going to go. Almost always, primary fruit is going to be bigger. It's going to be better. So you don't want to take off that primary fruit that's developing. But you can take some of the other ones off. With Meyer lemons, the branches will look as though they are falling off and they're going to rip off the tree because that fruit will be so heavy. So you might want to monitor how many are on each branch, but it actually will tolerate quite a bit of weight.
My mouth is watering thinking of all those wonderful Meyer lemons.
It's just fabulous. You can't beat.
One last quick question
sure.
on this. It went absolutely crazy producing blossoms. At one time, there were probably 200 to 300 blossoms on this.
Fabulous.
Tree.
Fabulous.
Must have smelled wonderful.
I thought, should I be pruning some of these things off?
Right now, this is another one of those yes and no questions. I would take a look at the structure by the window that you have it. Make sure you're turning it on a regular basis so that all sides get light. But then take a look as to whether you've got shaded areas on the inside, because they still do need an awful lot of light to produce the fruit. So if it looks as though you're getting a lot of shade on the inside, then you can go ahead and prune off. What they do in a lot of growth is they will just shear them off a couple of times a year. So it will respond very, very well to hard pruning after the fruit has developed and is off. And you can also root prune those things very nicely to keep them under control size-wise. But, you know, you enjoy them.
Yeah,
enjoy
it
them.
Sounds
and,
great.
And, I Wisconsin people shouldn't know this much about citrus, but for some strange reason, I do it. If you have any questions, you can go to my website and answer emails. So all you have to do is send me an email and I'll get you an answer.
That's thegardenhoe.com. Mm-hmm. Thanks for that call, Brahman. It really does sound like a wonderful plant.
The smell
it?
Is heaven.
Yeah. Oh.
The smell is heaven.
Well, you are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. We're happy to have Brian Huddleston from the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic at UW-Madison's Department of Plant Pathology and Liz Freemuth, who is the owner of The Garden Hoe, a passion for healthy and happy plants, providing concierge horticultural services with us today for Garden Talk. And we're happy to have you with us, too. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry. And it looks like Lynette in Hubertus is taking us back to our beloved maple trees. So let's go there. Hi, Lynette.
Hi. I have a few questions regarding black spot on maple. First of all, is it harmful to the tree? What can we do to get rid of it? And is it going to spread to other maples in its near vicinity?
Yeah, the disease is technically called tar spot, and that's what I call a cosmetic disease. I'm assuming you're talking about relatively large, maybe about quarter-sized black areas on the leaves. Is that correct?
Just to clarify.
And we've seen a lot of that. I consider it primarily a cosmetic disease. And what I tell folks in terms of management is just do good fall cleanup. You want to get rid of as many of those leaves that have those black spots as possible and get them out of your yard. That's where the fungus spends the winter. And it will survive in that leaf debris and will produce spores in the spring that can reinfect your maple trees. Now, whether or not it will spread to other maples depends a little bit on the particular species of the fungus that's involved. The one that we've been seeing most commonly here recently is one that is a European introduction that tends to go to Norway maple, and it tends to be relatively specific for that host. There are other variants of the disease that will go to other types of maples. And actually, there are a couple of variants of tar spot that will go to other hosts, like I believe willow I've seen it on, and holly I've seen a variant on it. Of it as well.
I've not seen it on holly yet.
Yeah, okay. I think it's holly that I saw it on one time several years ago. But in general, it'll be, quite frankly, it will be pretty much specific to Norway maples, at least the one that I've seen here in the Madison area. And I'm assuming you're probably seeing a similar version as well. But for all of these, quite frankly, just good fall cleanup is the best thing. If you start to see some defoliation on your maples due to this disease, which can occur on occasion, if that would continue for a couple of years, then I might consider some fungicide treatments. But at this point, I don't think it's severe enough to really warrant that sort of treatment.
But the defoliation was extremely severe this year, and compared to last year, which was the first year I noticed it.
Right.
So I was wondering.
Is it a mature tree?
Very, yes. Yeah.
Okay, and is that really the first time? Does it happen periodically you've noticed, or is this the first time?
No, this is the second, possibly the third year, but this year it defoliated rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the infections occurred relatively early this year, which I think contributed a little bit to the defoliation. That's more typical of when we'll see defoliation due to this disease. Did the tree leaf out later in the summer?
It did not this year, no.
Okay.
When did you see defoliation?
Probably in August.
Okay, there could be drought related. You had
and especially with a mature tree. And it was late enough. I actually likened what I saw in a lot of tree behavior this year to a crossing of the arms across their chest, leaning back and going, "I'm not doing this again this year." Where oftentimes we would, if it's like June or July,
right, early, then I would be more concerned.
We'll see a refoliation, and at that time, I agree with you. If we don't see it, then that's troublesome. But because of the drought we had, I'm not so worried about it.
Right.
That it didn't re-leaf, but
I would concentrate on cleanup this fall, good watering of the tree in the spring if we don't get rain again, and then watch the tar spot disease. If it looks like it's defoliating earlier in the season, then I would suggest it would be actually for 2014, then you could consider fungicide sprays. And we do have a fact sheet on this particular disease. You can find it at my website, and it does have some recommendations of fungicides, but again, I don't think it really at this point is warranted. Plus, those particular products, you need to make sure that you get them on early and get good coverage, which is going to be very difficult with a large mature tree. So you're really talking about having a professional arborist come out and do the treatment for you, in which case you're talking about a fairly substantial amount of money. And we really recommend three treatments. So you're talking about having them out three times early in the season. And again,
and
well-timed, and whether or not you can afford that is another issue to consider.
And just a reminder that the website that Brian referred to is the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, and it is pddc.wisc.edu. So thanks for that call, Annette. And
one more website I'll mention, because we talked about arborists.
We recommend
getting a certified arborist. Mm-hmm. And if you need to look for a local person who's certified as an arborist, I would go to the Wisconsin Arborist Association website, which is www.waa-isandsama.org.
And you can really choose by the service that you need done also. So you can go by location and then specialty of service, et cetera. And
they've got a very searchable database of arborists there.
Yeah, and finding an arborist is like finding a doctor. So, you know, don't go at it thinking that first phone call is always going to take care of your needs. You may have to search a little bit and find somebody you're comfortable with.
Great. Thanks for that call, Lynette. And I love how our listeners help out callers when they know something. Steve in Caledonia called to say that crown vetch is not toxic to cattle. They actually do well on it, and they don't bloat either.
Well, there you go. You know what? We love it. We love
it. And I bet the cows are happy not to bloat either. Well, Lucille in Luxembourg has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Lucille. Lucille?
Yes.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a rose that I got in May. It's called a parade rose. I have a couple questions, but anyways, how do I take care of that over the winter, being that I had it in a pot for the summer and it was just absolutely beautiful?
I'm not familiar with that particular cultivar. Do you know, is it winter hardy for us here? Was it a zone four?
Well, what it says on here is home and garden use, place in full sun or part shade, keep soil moist.
Does it have a zone on it any place?
When growing indoors, located in bright light. I don't see a zone.
Yeah, if I don't see a zone anywhere on it, I assume that that's a container rose that you can probably bring in for the winter if you can adjust it slowly. Well, right now we don't have a lot of time to adjust it slowly, but even over a week or so, either that or expect that all the leaves will fall off and it will relief. But you are going to have to take a little bit more intensive care of a rose that you're moving in, because it's a lot more prone to some indoor type issues. And, you know, especially I would be...
Spider mites would be the big thing that I notice on the indoor roses.
Spider mites.
Does it have relatively small flowers? Probably about the size
of
a quarter.
Is there about the size of a silver dollar?
Yeah.
The flowers. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't really dried. You know, I mean, you know, like the
keeps
buds,
going.
There was a couple buds that dried and fell off, but the flowers, and it's green, it really looks good, and
I don't know.
Yeah, and it sounds like an indoors type of rose as well, so I would not put that outdoors either. I would keep that inside. You're going to need a fair amount of light, I think, to keep that going, but you can get spider mites on those.
Again, if you keep humidity underneath without keeping the roots wet, you know, get a barrier in there of rocks, etc., that will actually help with those mites, so that you're keeping a moister environment, but not so moist that you're going to run into leaf fungi issue, you know, what have you. But I would say, yeah, definitely bring it in and give it a whirl. They actually make good houseplants if they get enough light, and light is the biggest thing.
All right. Thanks for that call, Lucille. And Roger in Kildare, Illinois is next. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I have a question about bee-bound flowers. They get this white. First of all, I don't water the leaves. I've been told not to get the leaves wet, so I just water the ground near the plant. But we, on some of them, we have them in about three or four sections of our yard, and we get this white powder on the leaves, and I'm told that that can be pretty dangerous, and I want to know how to deal with it. I'm told in some cases to wait till the spring and cut them down, make sure you dispose of it where it doesn't spread, or take it down now. And then I want to know, when you do cut the plant down, how far should you cut the plant down from the ground?
All right, let's see what Brian and Liz say.
That's one of my hit list for a group of diseases called the powdery mildews. You're actually seeing a fungus that's growing on the leaf surface, and Monardos are notorious for having problems with this particular disease. One question, how emotionally – well, actually, do you have a lot of crowding in your garden? Are there a lot of plants packed close together, or where you're seeing more of the disease is an area that's relatively shaded and a little bit close?
Well, as I say, we have them in five or six areas, and only had major problems in two areas. In the one area, it's in front of the house, and I think some of the blowover from the gutters lands on the leaves, and that could be the problem with that one, because it's...
Yeah.
Well,
interestingly, with this particular group of fungi, most of the time I tell folks, do not put... water on the leaves, just the way you're doing, because most fungi that infect leaves like wet periods in the leaves. The powdery mildews don't. They like dry leaf surfaces and high humidity. So the fact that you're seeing it near your water downspouts is probably an indication that it's a little bit more humid in that area. What you can do is try to thin the plants to get better airflow to move that out. Powdery mildews oftentimes are cosmetic diseases, although on Monardas they can cause some leaf browning that will actually cause the leaves to dehydrate, so that can be an issue. But usually Monardas are pretty tolerant. They're pretty tough plants, and they'll come back from the disease. You could move the plants to a new location, which gets a little better airflow and less humid air. And so that would be one thing to do. If you are not emotionally attached to this particular plant, this Monarda plant, then what you could consider would be to go to your garden center and look for a variety that has some disease resistance to powdery mildews. Those types of varieties are available, and that's an option. In terms of cutting down, you could cut down now. I would recommend that because the powdery mildew fungus is going to survive in that old debris. The downside is that powdery mildew is oftentimes overwintering buds on perennials. So some of the fungus is probably going to stick around even if you've cut the plants back. You can do that at this time of the year, quite frankly, or once they've kind of died back for the fall. But powdery mildews oftentimes are very, very cosmetic. We do have several fact sheets on my website, one that deals with herbaceous ornamentals, which a Monarda is in that particular group, that talks about powdery mildews. There is a baking soda and lightweight horticultural oil spray that you could use if you're absolutely desperate. But again, I usually think of these diseases as being primarily cosmetic.
Well, my solution for this in my own yard is that when I do have something that gets powdery mildew, cut flower, rip all the leaves off, toss them in water.
All right. That's good advice. It's Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, talking with Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemuth. Always a great conversation. A lot of us really love getting out and getting our hands dirty in the garden. Some plants seem to grow well no matter what, while others are very susceptible to pests and disease. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. So glad you could join us for Garden Talk. And our Garden Talk guests today have lots of great advice for a healthy garden. Liz Freemuth was previously a horticulturalist for Walworth County and is now the owner of The Garden Ho, which provides concierge horticultural services. Liz, thanks for coming by today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Love being here.
It's always fun, isn't it?
Oh, especially...
And speaking of fun, Brian Huddleston is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic at the UW-Madison's Department of Plant Pathology, also known, Larry tells me, as Dr. Death.
Well, that's my nickname. Mm-hmm.
Well,
I like my dead and dying plants. So,
okay.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm a true plant pathologist.
Well, Brian, always a pleasure to have you with
Thanks
us
for having
as
me.
Well. Let's look at some of the emails that we've gotten. Conrad in Mineral Point asks regarding those tar spots on maples that you guys recommended leaf removal. Would it be okay to burn those leaves, or would the smoke just spread that?
No, it should be fine to burn.
Okay.
It's a heat thing.
Yeah, if you get any release at this time of the year, likely the spores aren't going to survive.
And that's a non-judgmental thing about burning. That's
right.
A personal thing, and that's a legal issue. So if you're allowed to burn and that's something you want to do, I'm not making any judgments
so
on
just
that.
From a pathology point of view.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. And Sharon emailed, I have an magnolia tree that is about 8 feet tall and about 6 feet in diameter. When and how do I go about pruning it?
I would wait until after it flowers at this point, unless you have dead, dying, or crossing and rubbing branches. If you have dead branches, remove those anytime. If you have crossing branches that now you can see because the leaves are going to be gone, I would get that under control. Otherwise, you want to be a little judicious in your pruning on magnolias because they are a little slow growing. For the most part, they respond very, very easily. I wait until after flowering because why not get the best out of your flowers in spring, mm-hmm. then take it back a little bit.
Yeah, I would recommend between cuts,
yes,
disinfesting tools. I would use something like 70% alcohol, which you can find oftentimes in things like rubbing alcohol or some of the spray disinfectants. Just check the label. The reason I'm recommending that, you're talking a little bit about dying dead branches, which could have been killed off by some sort of pathogen, and you want to prevent spread of that by decontaminating tools.
I run around with rusty tools all the time, and it's not because I don't take care of them.
Are you using bleach?
I'm using bleach. I'm using alcohol. I'm using whatever I've got to hand. You know, I take that with me everywhere I go, and I'm glad you mentioned that because that is like first and foremost when you're out there working with your plants. That's the best defense right there.
If you're going to use bleach, it would be 10% bleach, and you're probably going to want to oil the tools routinely because that will tend to promote corrosion.
Yeah. So 10% bleach, 70% alcohol.
Alcohol.
Great. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's go back to the phones and check in with Ed in Milwaukee. Hi, Ed.
Hello, Judith. Thank you so much for taking my call. And
certainly.
Please pass on to Larry that this is one of the best shows on NPR.
I will do that.
Experts are always super, like today's. I've grown pole beans in our garden pretty much the same place for 3 or 4 years. But each year it seems I have to plant and replant 2 or 3 times to get the plants come up. Either they get eaten underground or the first shoots come up. I'm thinking it's slugs, but I just don't know what. It's driving me nuts.
So what's eating your pole beans?
Could be
what's
rodents, too.
It could be rodents, could be birds, could be a lot of things. It really depends on what the tissue looks like when your beans disappear. So does it look as though, I know that's an odd thing, but you really do have to look at, you know, Phil is so good that he can look at the chew
and tell you what,
yeah, and tell you what insect is chewing on it. If it's kind of yucky soft and it broke off, you know, it might be that it was damping off kind of issue, or
which is a fungal disease
that will happen if it's too wet, as those things are in that small stage. It could be that you have something underground, could be critters, squirrels, etc., that are eating early. We don't,
right.
You know, without looking at it.
If they get topped off and it looks like a very clean cut, then I would suspect some sort of small rodent, like a chipmunk, voles, mice, something of that sort.
Yeah.
If oftentimes slugs, when they will take out a plant, they can take out kind of a half moon out of the side of the stem, and then the plant will kind of collapse. But
it's a very pretty pattern that they have when they chew.
Yes.
Yeah, it is.
That's very generous of you.
My concern from a disease standpoint is that you've been planting those beans in the same location many years. You can build up soil-borne pathogens that can cause disease problems. I would consider moving your pole beans to another location in your garden. In general, when you're growing a vegetable garden, it's very important to move the plants around so you don't get that buildup in the soil.
And really optimally is about a 4 to 5 year rotation, so that you're in different families in that spot. So it's not that you're going to bush beans in that area.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're going to a different family, not a legume of any sort. Go to something else.
So Liz, you're saying that like beans might be in that area year one and not again until year five, and then not again until year 10.
And sometimes that's very difficult in a small garden,
in which
case I sometimes talk to folks about doing containerized gardens where you can change the soil out each year. So that's another option.
And disinfect the containers, you know, so you go with clay or porcelain or something like that rather than a plastic, which you can disinfect effectively with heat.
It's called incineration,
unfortunately.
Yes. We do run into problems that we can't decontaminate plastic sometimes adequately when you've got a disease problem.
Okay.
So we typically recommend going with some sort of ceramic or clay.
All right. Yeah. Well, thanks for that call, Ed, and good luck with your beans. And
send us a picture.
Yeah,
when it happens.
Actually.
Send us a picture.
I will. So super response. Thank you.
Thanks, Ed. Take care. And June in Washburn is up next. Hi, June.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have some spruce, the evergreen trees in the yard, and I've been told what they have is called needle cast, C-A-S-T, where towards the trunk, the needles are turning like an orangish color.
Mm-hmm. Aren't they pretty?
No, I don't like it, really.
That was rather tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Okay. It's probably...
Are they dying?
No. In the overall sense of the tree, the individual needles that are turning brown, yes, they're dying back, and they will not come back. The tree itself is not dying. These sort of needle casts aren't going to kill the tree. What you probably have is a needle cast called rhizosphera needle cast. It's the most common needle cast that I see on spruce, particularly if you're growing blue spruce or Colorado blue spruce. And it's unfortunately what you're paying for is probably Liz is hitting me here because I tend to use my hands a lot when I talk, so she's telling me stop it, Brian. In any event, you're probably paying for our wet weather that we had back in 2009 and 2010, because that really set us up for a lot of infections, and now you're just seeing kind of the result of that. The fungus gets in, kind of sticks around, but doesn't cause symptoms.
Well, and also up in Washburn, that was in the area that got so much rain.
But again, I wouldn't expect what you're seeing on those interior needles, from this year. You'll be lucky to have the disease again a couple years down the road. Unfortunately, there's nothing you can do about it other than
on those particular needles.
Yeah. If you are really, really concerned and want to try to rejuvenate the tree, you're really going to have to go to some sort of routine fungicide sprays that you're going to be doing every year. And again,
well-timed.
It needs to be the treatments need to start when the needles are first emerging. and continue until they're fully expanded. And sometimes you need additional treatments throughout the entire growing season if it's really wet.
Yeah, wet and appropriate temperatures, because otherwise you've wasted the time and the money you spent.
And the money,
yeah.
That's right. Mm. And so it's a tough disease to keep under control. It's not fatal, though. It's not going to kill your tree. I just tell folks that sometimes it's so severe that you wish your trees were dead.
Mm. Yeah.
Then that's a time when you consider replacement. And then you go with something, particularly if you're growing blue spruce, you go with something other than blue spruce. I think black hill spruce is a nice replacement in the spruce.
Serbian spruce also have done very well.
They get a little bit of these diseases, but not nearly as severe as blue spruce.
So you don't want to put something in that's just going to be another
problem. And part of the problem is that blue spruce was the thing to put in 20, 30 years ago, and everybody had them, and it's very susceptible.
And they're beautiful.
They are.
We understand why people like them.
I just don't ever see healthy ones. That's the problem.
Up until
job.
About year 15.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say your job.
Yeah, I see the bad and the ugly. Yes. I don't usually see the good. The other thing you could consider that's got similar coloring, but you've got to have well-drained soil and you have to make sure it gets adequate water, is a white fir. Mm-hmm. They have very similar coloring, but they do tend to be a little bit prone to root rots if you've got a heavier clay soil.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck with that, June. We wish you and your evergreen the best. We actually had an email from Lynn who says we have a 40 to 50 foot tall balsam growing less than 20 feet from the shoreline of a lake that is dropping needles. I assume the tree is dropping needles. The needles covering the ground are green, and the tree looks stressed all over. It appeared fine during the summer. Is my shade tree dying, she asks.
Most likely, yes. Based on the description that you're providing for me. Firs tend to have a lot of problems in my mind, again, with root rots. And if it's near a lake, it may have a root infection that's gotten established from having relatively wet soil conditions.
And I would do a wait and see, this fall.
You take it out.
Yeah, and I'm doing a wait and see on a lot of things because, again, you know, go back to what we talked about at the beginning, is that there's a lot of stuff we had, these conditions we have not seen. And so I'm not really sure how some of these things are going to respond. I know that balsams do not respond well to the heat. And so, you know, we'll do I hate to see anything turn on a balsam, because when it does that, that's not good. Like Brian said, that is not good. The one in my yard that was only supposed to live about 8 years and it's now 40 feet tall did the same thing, where the interior needles all of a sudden did we're not going to live here anymore. So I'm not sure what that means for the tree.
Right.
And so I'm looking at it as a potential Christmas tree, just in case.
Watch for with that particular host, well, and trees in general, is watch for any mushrooms that form around the base of the tree.
Yeah.
There is a fungal pathogen that produces mushrooms that can cause a lot of root damage. They produce what are called honey mushrooms. The name of the fungus is Armillaria. If you see any mushrooms coming up around the base of that tree, I would really recommend getting a sample into our clinic for an identification, because if you have that particular disease, that has a fairly broad host range and can take out other types of woody ornamentals as well.
Yeah.
All right. And let's go to Angie in Milwaukee next. Hi, Angie.
Hello. I have a butterfly bush. It's got beautiful purple spires on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really just gotten huge over the past year. It's like 8.5 feet tall and 6 feet in diameter. It's a little bit bigger than I really thought it would be.
Can I ask you, how many years has it been in?
About 3 years.
Okay.
It just went crazy this year. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, when should I cut it back? Should I cut it back? And how would I do that?
In the past 3 years, have you cut it back?
No.
And did it actually leaf out? Did you have any dead tissue on the ends of it? Or did it actually leaf out all the way to the end in spring?
It leafed out. It went crazy.
Yeah,
nice.
It was a mild winter.
Yeah,
and
nice.
I heard that a lot of
people had
butterfly bushes that did really well. Normally, I see those die back in the wintertime around here.
Exactly. We call them a sub-shrub because it really is shrubby in nature, but we typically expect those to die back to the ground and come up from the root. So the fact that you've had it and it has leafed out all the way along the branches, if we get another mild winter, it may do just fine. You can cut that back. I would wait until early spring, until you start to see some nubbins of leaves, and then do a judicious pruning on that. That's one of those that oftentimes if you take it off too early in the fall or in the winter, it doesn't like you for that. And it will kind of just sit on its haunches and go, so they're fine, I'm not going to grow this year. So you might want to just wait until you start to see leaves emerge. I kind of lump that in with the Caryopteris and Blue Mispyrea and some of the other plants that really don't like to be messed with until they start to exhibit growth.
And the thing of it is, the winter may do the pruning for you.
Exactly.
So I would hold off as well.
Mm-hmm. And I guess when you say judicious pruning, I know sometimes when you talk about pruning, it's kind of like, you know, a third of the branches or something like that. When you say judicious, what kind of proportions are we talking about?
When I refer to judicious, it's don't just get the hedge clippers out there and whack it off at 2 feet, because you want to take a little bit of care in what you're cutting and where. With a shrub like a butterfly bush, you don't want to prune so that you're encouraging the growth to go towards the center of the plant, because that's one that has a real open, loose, vase-like shape. And if you prune off all of those buds that are going to grow to the outside, you're going to create some disease, potential disease issues on the interior of the plant as those branches rub, etc. So it's take a look at where the leaf nodes are. Make sure that you're making those cuts to encourage growth to the outside of the plant, not to the inside. Mm-hmm. And not do a hedge clip. Do not meatball the shrubs. And some shrubs respond beautifully to meatballing, but this is one where it's take your cuts one at a time.
Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure that we...
And disinfect. Yeah. Sorry, I had to throw that
10%
in.
10% bleach, 70% alcohol. I will remember that. We've talked a lot about how important fall cleanup is, but I want to make sure that people really know what that is. I mean, you talked about removing the debris of, say, vegetable plants that have stopped growing. What other fall cleanup should we be doing? Brian, you want to start?
Leaf removal is the big one for me, and also cutting back in perennials, although we just have a new fact sheet that's about to come out where this talks about pollinators. And so some of the bees will actually be in those old plant stalks. So you have to be a little bit careful if you're removing that you don't remove all of your pollinators as well. But from a disease standpoint, cutting back perennials, removing annual plants that have died back, removing leaves from trees, it's that old dead plant material, that's where the disease-causing organisms tend to hang out. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not averse to you doing it in the spring. I just usually think people have more time in the fall to do that than in the spring. If you're like me, spring gets busy, and then if I haven't done stuff in the fall, it just doesn't get done.
And then it multiplies.
Yes, indeed.
Multiplies horribly.
Come to my yard and see how that happens. Yes, indeed.
And for me, the leaf cleanup, where I live, it's out in the open. So leaf cleanup is the lawnmower that's going to mulch them, and they get blown away for the most part. But we do have to monitor what gets a heavy dose of oak leaves on it so that it's not choking out the plants. But if there's a disease, I'm kind of up a creek, because my yard is so big, I can't get all the leaves, and I get the neighbors and I get everything else. But instances where you've got diseases, leaf vacs are a savior, because to me, that's the only reason to get a leaf vac out is to get those leaves up so that you're getting all that disease tissue up and off of the yard.
And I would not mulch those safe.
No,
we were talking about tar spot. I would not go out with a mulcher and mulch that material
because
those little bits of leaf that you cut up, the fungus is still there and it's going to survive the winter.
Yeah, it's so small, cutting it is not going to make any difference, none whatsoever. And for me, the perennials that really have to be taken down now are the peonies.
Okay.
When you're looking at what do you cut back, when I'm one of those that will do it when I have time, and I am so tired in my own yard. I'm so tired by this time of the year, I don't like to do a lot of cutback, because it's just, I'm tired. But the peonies, definitely.
Okay.
Get those cut at the ground level, because otherwise you'll get stuff moving in through the stalks over winter, and you don't want that. Otherwise, so many can be just left alone, and they look beautiful in the
snow. Right, especially like grasses. It gives a lot of winter interest.
Coneflowers.
Retain snow as well, which can be important for insulation.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And what about mulching?
Mulching not until the ground freezes solid.
Okay.
I encourage mulching if it's needed, but we're looking at, you know, really a couple of inches is all you need. Any more than 4 on roots of trees and you're going to start suffocating the roots. They need air. And so 4 inches, too much. Now, if you're trying to kill something, 4 inches is perfect. But
and
if you're protecting...
on soil type as well.
Exactly. And if you're protecting a construction site, you know, where if you're going to have some construction going on in your yard, 4 inches of mulch will actually moderate that foot traffic in an area. So in some instances, yes, it's okay. But mulch definitely after the ground freezes solid. You don't, and that is a rodent issue. What you're trying to do with mulch is moderate the temperature, not lower or raise it. Mm-hmm. You're moderating the effects of the weather around it. Just be careful that if you put it against any kind of trunk, that you're removing it so that you don't get rot mm-hmm. on any kind of hard right. trunk tissue.
And is there still time to plant bulbs?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Bulbs, if they have had their cold treatment, they're all good. I have to admit, I've planted them in February when we've had a slight thaw, and they're 6 inches of thawed earth, and I, you know, dig them and put them in, and you can get some flowering off of that. That's not recommended, but in my yard, I'll experiment, and it actually worked. But what we need are soil temps going down, which is what we have, from 60 on their way down, and they love the moisture this time of the year. They love the snow cover. It, you know, this is the time of year for them, so definitely.
Good. I'm glad to hear that because I have jonquils and crocuses and hyacinths, I think.
Go for it.
And does anything benefit from fertilizing this time of year?
Yeah, I would not fertilize. Now that we're starting to lose leaves on the shade trees, you can put down some slow-release fertilizer for next fall. The evergreens, you know, yeah, I think we can. I really, other than the 10 days we're going out here, if we get temps in the 50s to 60s after that, then you might spur a little bit of growth.
Yeah,
so
that's
I'm hesitant
my concern
on
about
evergreens.
This time of the year,
yeah.
Because if you stimulate that foliar growth,
yes.
And we get a cold snap, you can get a
yeah.
lot of cold damage.
Exactly. Okay. So we're at that iffy time. This is another one of those, I don't know what's going to happen this year, because we really don't know what's mm-hmm. going to happen
so
this year.
So it's certainly not necessary at this time of year.
No. Okay. Other than, I mean, the end of October is the last, really, that's the important last date for turf fertilization. So yes, definitely.
Okay.
We're still in line
so
for
just
that
turf.
One.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Let's take a quick call from Chris in Eau Claire. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show today. I have a sapling that we got from my neighbor's land up north, about an hour north of Eau Claire, and we planted it last fall, and it seemed to do fine over the winter. We watered it really well when we planted it.
And what kind of sapling?
A little maple.
Oh, okay.
And so far, all summer, it's been a twig in our yard. We didn't have any leaves come out, even though there were little buds on it. There are some shoots from the bottom, like 3 or 4 shoots from the bottom that got leaves.
Okay.
Like when I rubbed the bark mm-hmm. off, it's still green.
On the main one, it is.
Yeah,
you know what? This is going to be a short answer. Wait and see.
Okay.
I mean that seriously,
yeah.
Because
we have,
if you're
we have
seeing
family members making fun of us,
I say put some Christmas lights on that baby. Make sure they're
your Charlie
LEDs.
Brown maple tree.
Yeah, make sure they're LEDs so you don't encourage any scale behavior. But put some LEDs on that baby and make yourself proud, because if it still has green tissue in the main trunk, I would say just do a wait and see what happens in the spring. You know, you brought it down. It's got a little bit of meaning for you there. Why not? Make yourself happy. LEDs, good Christmas.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Chris. And I want to make sure people know where to find both of you online. So, Brian, why don't you give us the Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab?
Yeah, it's pddc.wisc.edu.
And we do have that on the Facebook page. We also have Liz's...
www.thegardenhoe.com.
H-O-E.
H-O-E. And there is only one, so there is a the in front of
there
it.
There you go. And we also have a link up for the certified arborists list, too, so people can find that there. Well,
great
Brian
group.
Huddleston and Liz Freeman, thanks so much for joining us today. It was fun, as always.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thanks.
And Monday, Larry will be back, and at 11, he will be talking with author Kathleen Ernst about her latest murder mystery. It's called The Lightkeeper's Legacy, and it's set on Rock Island in Door County. Then at 11:45 Monday, the weather guys are here to tell us about Hurricane Sandy and the potential Frankenstorm. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned.